to my stern words about not being late, I'm not on time. How bad is that? Okay, ladies and gentlemen, if I can ask you to take your seats and we'll get the last session going for this afternoon. Our next speaker, we're changing context again. We're now moving to Marine, and our next speaker is Howard Ram. He's the Staff Officer Operations, is that right? Staff Officer Operations for the Royal National Lifeboat Institute. He's been working in the field for 20 years, and his current role involves responsibility for planning the strategic direction for training the volunteers and full-time employees of the Royal National Lifeboat Institute. So, over to you.
Thank you. Well, good afternoon. First of all, as with everybody else, I'd like to thank you for the kind invitation to come and speak to you today. I feel a little bit out of my environment, if I'm quite honest, been talking about airs and air and rail and things like that, but never mind, we'll get over that. Thank you for the introduction. I think the other thing, and this was mentioned earlier about operators as against the bean counters and the businessmen, I'm quite pleased to say that I've actually come to the position I am with the RNLI from originally being a volunteer crew member. So it's quite nice to sort of bring that back now into my new role and look at it from the operational point of view. I'd also like to pick up on something Rick said as well quite early on, which is quite important for our world, which is it is that fine line between hero and villain, really. I think, you know, it's easy to get the headlines when the rotors miss or when you get the crew back in one piece after the capsize, but it's very easy to get all the bad headlines if it goes hideously wrong and everybody's swept up a beach. What I'd like to do first of all is give you a bit of an insight, I suppose, into our world. I'm going to show you two video clips, one of it going quite well, one of it not going quite so well, which just give you an indication of why straight away you can see that human factors may be relevant to our world. The first clip is Canada in 1989. It's a crew of a rescue boat. There are three rescuers on board. They're attempting to recover a person from the water against definitive instructions from their mothership. The Canadians launched these boats off the side of other ships, and against the advice of a doctor ashore who said he's quite happy to medically certify that the person would not survive as they've been face down in the water for 1 hour. However, this is what happens. I apologize for the language, but it is real. Okay, so obviously the bad side of the line, that one, the side of the line that gets the headlines. The other side of the line, when it goes well, is Torbay, 2007. Seven volunteer crew, who've all got other professional jobs, attempting to recover seven survivors from the 50,000-ton ice print, which later was to sink in the channel under tow. It's a very stabilised camera, and the fact that it says gun not loaded tells you where it was filmed from. To give you some indication, the lifeboat you're looking at is a 17-metre boat, 55 feet. Okay, so just a couple of short clips there to sort of give you a brief insight into my world. Not that much different from your world. High risk, high tech, high consequence. I think probably the big change for our world, the other added extra, I suppose, is it's highly fluid. Haha, excuse the pun. Highly fluid, as in the circumstances are changing, the environment is changing, it's not pre-planned. These things happen in the middle of the night, and you don't know where you're going until you arrive. So that throws another quite interesting element in there. So the title of my presentation today is Implementing Human Factors Training and Simulation Afloat for the RNLI. My aim is to give you an understanding of the RNLI's approach to human factors training for our full-time and volunteer coxswains and mechanics. I'm going to touch on four key areas, really. I'm going to tell you a little bit, first of all, about who the RNLI are, for those of you who may not be familiar. Why has the RNLI implemented human factors training? How has human factors training been implemented? And what have the outcomes been? Hopefully there'll be a little bit of time at the end for questions, if should there be any. So first of all, then, who are the RNLI? Well, we're a charity. We're the charity that saves lives at sea. And like all good charities and good organisations, we have a clear vision. We provide a 24-hour rescue service to 100 nautical miles offshore from 235 strategic locations with 335 rescue boats. We also operate a number of other areas, lifeguard services, as well as hovercraft and flood response teams. Again, like all organisations, we've got performance standards and strategic targets listening earlier, you will now notice ours are quite number-based. Funny that. Here we go. So that just gives you an indication of the spread of the organisation as a charity, the number of things we're involved in, and probably maybe slightly larger than some of you would have thought. As you can see there, in addition to the lifeboats at the bottom and the map telling us the number area of coverage we've got, we also operate a seasonal lifeguard service on 143 beaches. It's a slightly different funding model for that because we are a charity. However, we do receive a contracted funding from local councils for the provision of that service. We also have international and national flood response teams. The national flood response model is increasing all the time. If you've spent your summer in the UK the last couple of years, you will sympathise with that. We're not the only marine rescue service in the UK, but 9 out of 10 rescues are conducted by RNLI volunteers and crew members. We've been in the go and operation since 1824, and in that time we've saved, and by saved I mean rescue people who would otherwise have died, not just brought ashore, where there have been 138,000 lives saved by the RNLI. So that's a little bit about the funding and the services, of where the funding comes from as a charity. But what does it actually cost? Well, it costs £335,000 a day to run the RNLI. That's, for those of you quick at maths, that's £122 million per annum. Small budgets compared to some of yours, I suspect. Our boats range from £31,000 to the Tamar class, which is the bottom left there, our latest vessel, which is £2.7 million per vessel. We're very fortunate as an organisation that we are still currently run by operators. We're not yet run by purely businessmen and bean counters. As an organisation, we could not function. There's no justification other than a moral one of spending £2.7 million on a boat that might go out 10 times a year. But it's in a strategic location. It fulfils that net. I hope, and we've had the CEO discussion a little bit, haven't we? New CEO coming along. I hope he has a similar vision, that it's about providing a service and providing a public service, bearing in mind we are funded entirely by the public. And the final thing I did say, and I mentioned earlier, is that all our vessels, with the exception of one guaranteed full-time man as a maintenance mechanic at our lifeboat stations, are funded by operated by volunteers, people who have other jobs. And currently, only 8% of those volunteers are actually marine professionals. So 92% require training of some variety. So that's a little bit about the RNLI. Next, why is the RNLI implemented human factors training? Well, history, I suppose. Let's look at that first of all before we move on to looking at the technology and, unfortunately, some of the incidents we've had. Well, that's probably a historic image some people have got of the RNLI. Local crew, sailing, pulling tight boat. In these sorts of days for the RNLI, probably the equation was reversed. I would argue that probably in the region of 92% of people on board that lifeboat were seafarers. They went to sea, they fished, they sailed, they understood the sea. Equally, you can probably see by looking at it, it's not a particularly technologically advanced piece of equipment. There are not multiple information streams coming into the coxswain, there's not multiple amounts of decisions, and actually things are happening fairly slowly, so we're not having to make decisions at high speed. So less information critical, still harshly team involved, but a much more hierarchical structure, a much more hierarchical style of management was applicable to these styles of vessels. In more recent times, obviously, we've changed. The endurance of our vessels has changed, the technology has changed, and I'll come on to technology in a moment. But from a historical training point of view, in 2002, the RNLI implemented a competence-based training framework similar to the types we've seen thrown upon the board, units, numbers, activities. We spent quite a lot of time and effort inventing what we know as the imaginary activity 12, leadership, command, soft bits, the woolly bits, the human bits. We didn't roll it out at the time, and the reason we didn't roll it out was we thought it was too challenging and a step too far for a volunteer demographic and a highly traditional demographic. In terms of a competence, a measured competence and assessed competence, we still haven't rolled it out. However, we are providing training in it. What we couldn't ignore, of course, is not just purely from the operational point of view, but also the shoreside point of view, is 90% of the major problems within the RNLI were people problems. They still are people problems. Now, they may be shoreside, they may be operational, and maybe afloat. But that was really a key trigger point for us to look at implementing management, command, and communication training for our boat officers and our coxswains. It was a time we got to. It had to be done. And as I said, that was implemented. So that's a little bit of the background. What about our technologies? Where are we at technology-wise? Well, let's have a quick look at a new slide. This is the latest lifeboat. This is a Tamar class lifeboat, £2.7 million. Human factors in the design of this lifeboat were massive. Ourselves, along with other industries, sat down and produced, it's about a 200-page document on human factors in high-speed vessels, all to do with ergonomics, positioning, equipment layout, information streams being simple, and how we got our guys back in one piece if the worst happened. And we are, fortunately, because again, we're operator-driven, we are in the luxury of being able to design our boats for the one in 10-year occurrence, so that the boat brings guys home in one piece. If they have a Torbay type incident and take the rails off the boat, it's not going to take the integrity of the boat away. So as you can see, we've got sophisticated craft. Some of the screens you can see there is, you will notice, for those of you, if any of you are mariners, and I notice there's a doctor from Warsash here, so she'll be familiar with this. The wheelhouse of the Tamar class has no wheel, so that was quite a challenge for what we should name it. It's joystick control, it's fly-by-wire technology, it's very sophisticated technologically, but with the aim of simplifying the end-user inputs and the end-user outputs. So we're trying to use advanced technology to make it easier, not more difficult. I'll come back to whether we've achieved it in a moment. So that's the technologies we've got. You can see some of the screen dumps and the boat there for yourselves, and sort of one of the operational screens there. So what about the incidents we've had? Well, like all organisations, you have incidents, things go wrong. Something we noticed over a period of time is we got the boats pretty good. They go out there in all weathers, they're strong if you like, you can do what you like with them really, you can run them aground at full speed, they'll survive it, they'll bring the crew home. We've got all these nice information streams running, simple, usable information, simple screens, Windows type technology familiar to our crews. Despite this, we've actually had an increase in accidents and basic errors. And that we can put that down to the fact that, I think it was Rick mentioned it earlier on, and somebody else, is our guys now sit there expecting to be fed the information. I'm used to being fed the information, therefore if it doesn't come and smack me in the face, maybe I didn't look at the navigational chart electronically as often as I should have done. Maybe I didn't worry about the radar because I thought the alarm was going to go off. Maybe I didn't tell the rest of my crew what my plan was, and articulate what the parameters were and set the boundaries of this service, because I kind of thought the machines had pointed out when it was going wrong and they understood what I needed. So we couldn't avoid the fact that we'd had some basic incidents. I'm just going to talk to you about a couple of the basic incidents that were the trigger. But I think we've arrived at the same point you've all arrived at, which is technologically we're there. The problem is the nut's still loose on the wheel, if you know what I mean. Okay, think about that one. It wasn't too deep. Okay, we look at three incidents. Primary causes of these incidents range from lack of ability to interpret their position, lack of awareness of position, excessive speed, these sorts of things. However, the secondary and contributory factors are all common, and they're the sorts of things we've all been talking about. So let's look at this incident, a collision between two life. As you can see from all the bunting and paraphernalia there, what we were doing, we were showboating, we were doing a PR job. Okay, when's it going to go wrong? When your finger's off the ball. How many people are on those two boats? 14 people capable of spotting that and doing something about it. How many of them did? Obviously none, by the look of it. Highly embarrassing when you're a charity and your largest documented strategic risk is risk to reputation. Because if it is the RNLI, we lose the reputation that we have and the support that we have for our crews. There's no money in the pot to do anything. So when you've got a strategic number one risk of risk to reputation, it's a good job it's only us that have got the photograph. Second incident. This happened in the 90s. Fairly obvious what's happened. Run out of the sticky stuff. causes of this incident and why. You'll also notice I've been very quiet in the name of the lifeboat off for those of you who live on the coast. I'll give you a quick of a run into this. A coxswain, quite traditional in his style of management, turned up to a service. This was a service call. As you can see from the photograph, in thick fog. He was so determined to go and get on with the service without really analysing how complex the service was, whether or not the level of risk to the casualty really justified as dashing out there straight away, flat out. Took the first five guys that turned up there, steamed out off on his own. They were inexperienced. They weren't the A1 crew. They weren't the sort of crew you'd have ideally taken in restrictive visibility for a service call. He also chose, against the advice of one of his junior crew who did speak up, to ignore him because he didn't think he knew what he was talking about, and historically what happens then, of course, the rest of the crew shut up, don't say anything, stand back. The guy who spoke up stood back and thought, well, fine, you know what you're doing, crack on. The others weren't prepared to speak up because of the way they've been dealt with, the previous chap had been dealt with. That was the result. Fortunately, again, no injuries, no damage to the boat in this instance. A third incident, again, you'll see the secondary causes are very similar. Not a great headline when you've just had the Queen name this lifeboat. Not on the same day, luckily, because that's what the press draw up on. Ooh, boat named by the Queen gets a little bit of damage. As you know, the Falmouth area, the Manacles Rock's quite famous. Again, familiarity and PR type trip, taking out another lifeboat crew from another area who've got a smaller, less Gucci vessel. Let's take you out, show you how the Seven works, boys. No clear briefing to the bridge team. No clear parameters set around the radar as in terms of my intention is to do this. If we go within a mile, give us a shout. If the depth gets down to this, give us a shout. Put a couple of parallel lines on the radar maybe so we can see if we're going through the right gap. Interestingly, with this incident, the guy on the radar saw this arriving. Saw this arriving, communicated it to the bridge. The guy was on the upper steering position, external there, which you know we wouldn't recommend because although you might think it's good, you can see what's going on, you're away from all your instrumentation and all the feedback. He said, yeah, not a problem, I got it covered, that's fine. No worries. And the crew, remaining crew, sat in the wheelhouse, saw the incident unfold, and none of them had the confidence to contradict the coxswain and pull the throttles back. And bearing in mind, there's a set of throttles in the wheelhouse. It's a case of press a button and do that, and we could have stopped the boat. So you can see from that, quite a nasty headline for us, doesn't help the reputation side of things, and quite a bit of damage to the boat. I'm going to reverse that back round now and make you feel warm and cuddly again. That's three incidents out of 20,000 launches for exercises and services per annum, and that's the only, actually four, because I'm going to talk about another one in a minute. That's the only four I could find in the last 10 years. So the stats aren't too bad, but of course it does bring the point home, doesn't it? The final incident I'm going to discuss is a similar one. I couldn't find any photographs of this one. We've obviously buried this report deeply in our archive where we didn't want it. But just to bring the point home further, and it was the one I really wanted to discuss and have some pictures of, really, but a similar incident with a lifeboat going on a service call, no assessment of the critical nature of the casualty, i.e. the casualty had broken down, was drifting, but didn't really need rescuing immediately, out the harbour, 25 knots, which is flat out, and to give you a relative term, times it by about three to give you an equivalent road speed, I suppose, so equivalent to about 80 miles an hour, into thick fog, targets identified on the radar. Again, coxswain did nothing about it, came within 4 feet of cutting in two a pilot boat. Okay, had he been 4 feet to the left, he would definitely have killed people on board that boat. As it happened, it was sort of a glancing swipe. There were a lot of lessons for the crew in the fact they could have interjected, but he was against so many seamanshipy type rules that it's not even worth going there, really. But just another example for you. So really, why have we implemented it? Well, background, we haven't taught it, we haven't been there. Our trigger points have been there in terms of both our people problems and in terms of our incidents. And we've also picked up from a trigger point that despite our technology getting much better, people are still making basic errors because they're not used to monitoring it themselves, is my take on it personally. So how have we implemented the training? Well, I'm going to look at three areas here as well. We've had a number of challenges in doing this, as you would have, and I think I hear similar vibes coming from the rail guys that are in the room. So look at the challenges, look at the delivery methodology we've chosen, and also going to talk a little bit about simulation, as that seems to be on the agenda as well quite a lot here. So first of all, the challenges. Well, let's look at our demographic first of all. Not only are people volunteers, they're not paid by us, it's a hobby, you know, so I don't really need a lot of hassle when I come and do this for free, Howard, if that's okay. But also, they're very wide social spectrums. So we've got doctors on crews, we've got teachers, we've got highly professionals, accountants, solicitors. The likelihood is, socially, in general social terms, that the coxswain would probably be in normal walk of life, not the top dog. However, when he's on board his vessel, he's got some very well educated and experienced people on board that he's in charge of. Interesting challenge. Equally as well, when we look at that, if we look at tradition a little bit, and we talked about tradition and families, I think it was the rail industry talked about families doing the same thing. Well, that's as traditional as you get. That's an old style coxswain in the front just shouting out to do it all, and they row, you know, row faster, please. We look at this little family here. This is the Cockings of St. Ives. If you know anything about lifeboats, you will know. I've only got three photographs, although there are five generations of Cockings have been involved with the lifeboat service, three of whom have made coxswain, two of whom are crew members. Tommy's actual grandfather never made coxswain because In 1939, unfortunately, his great-grandfather, along with three other of his family members, were killed in a disaster off St. Ives. And he kind of eased back a little bit, thinking the family have kind of put enough into this for a generation or two. But he came back to the next generation, and Tommy is still the current coxswain. So we're a staunchly traditional organisation in beliefs and changing beliefs and ideas. Now, if you said to Tommy, and I'll throw this in there because I like this when he says this to people. If you said to Tommy, that's a fantastic family tradition, Tommy. That's a really great tradition. He would say to you, it's not a tradition. It's a complete lack of imagination. So those are some of our challenges. So what about the delivery method we went for? Well, we've gone for a staged process. We haven't steamed in there. The management, command and communication course we run, which I'm part of running, we've got one element in there, thread through the week, which is clearly human factors. It's a communications element. We're looking at all the things you've been talking about. We're looking about clear communications, leadership styles, how does that affect communications, an open communications environment on your bridge, encouraging the most junior guy to speak up and say, coxswain, have you seen that? And the coxswain go, I have, thank you very much. Not, of course I bloody have, you prat. Yeah. And also verbalising their thoughts, verbalising what's going on, briefing people, setting parameters. Interestingly, what we have done is decided not to do that internally. We've brought external people in to do that, and that's for two or three very good reasons. First of all, the main reason is, if I stood up and did it, I'm not a human factors specialist for one, and the RNLI doesn't employ any. Secondly, well, you're just that bloke from the senior management of the RNLI trying to tell me how to drive my lifeboat. You haven't been on a lifeboat for 4 years, Howard. You go out twice a year. What do you really know about it? So by bringing in externals, we get a couple of advantages. First of all, credibility and impact. As I said, the trainer's not just some dude from the RNLI telling you how to do it. They're an external professional human factors trainer, in our case from the airline industry, and we bring the airline human factors guys in. What's the advantage of that? Well, it's non-technically threatening. When the guy stands up, or Nicole stands up and says, this is sort of human factor stuff, guys, in communication. By the way, I don't know anything about driving a lifeboat. Oh, cool. We'll dig that. We can work with that because now I'm not feeling threatened. I'm just feeling like I can relate. I can sit and take from it what you want me to take from it. I can absorb that information, and it's not really a threat to my professional standing. And I can ask silly questions because you're not going to laugh at me from a lifeboat point of view. And thirdly, as well, bearing the complex social dynamics that we have, they're impartial to the RNLI. So they're not threatening that difficult social dynamic that's unique to their station. It's a closed door session. What's said in the room stays in the room. And for us as an organisation, it's worked wonderfully. And if anybody suggested within the RNLI, we get our own human factors people and train it ourselves, I would be really, really anti doing it. Because it's just worked so well to get over the hurdle and the barrier, if you like. Secondly to this, then, what we do is to try and bring it back and get the true relationship there is we do run a number of case studies around proper marine incidents. But we've tried to up the ante. It's not lifeboat incidents. These are maritime incidents by people that our guys see as full-time professional seafarers making the same mistakes that they're making, making the same mistakes that your train drivers are making and that the airline pilots are making and that other people are making. But what it's about doing is getting them to look at that from an impartial view, draw their own conclusions, and then bring it back to, well, how does that affect me? How can I amend the things I do on my lifeboat tomorrow from a human factors point of view? Now, the case studies we've picked are very specific case studies. So they are things that work around the style of bridge team we have, the style of management we have, and things that we can draw a direct parity to. So one of our incidents is fatigue-based, is competence-based, is crewing levels based. So we go through it all, they come out with all the answers, they've been great, they've got a pretty good grasp of these things, and then we can throw them the question, okay, so how many times do you go to sea with the crew you didn't ideally want? In the middle of the night when all your lads have been working all day, when you don't know what the mission is and you haven't really got a passage plan, and it's a 14-hour job, and you've only got you as the coxswain on board, to try and just bring home and make them think about it. But it's still not challenging them directly, because for our world, you know, we found that, well, we believe that's not the correct route for us to take. So that's a little bit about the delivery methodology. I said I would talk about simulation. I did have a shot of our simulator and some video footage, but unfortunately it won't play on this particular machine. But in terms of our training and simulation, well, the RNLI invested heavily in its own college, and we now have the Lifeboat College down at Poole. which encompasses not only classrooms, training rooms, a survival tank, a capsized pool, a wave tank for all these sorts of things, but it also has got a full mission bridge simulator of the 7-class lifeboat, which is our largest lifeboat. So when we started the training, it seemed blindingly obvious. We do a bit of human factory type stuff. We bring in the professionals, we get them to teach it. We throw the guys in the simulator. We get all the learning points out and everybody's happy. Didn't work like that. Why have we got a simulator? Well, we've got a simulator because we've got full control over it. We can add things to it. We can, as you know enough about simulation. I don't need to tell you that. So we've got control, safety, we bring the cost down. However, we identified some disadvantages quite early on. We've got people in the room trying to teach them about human factors, trying to start them thinking about the soft bit, the nice bit, what they see as the pink and fluffy cuddly stuff. You know, we're trying to get them to start thinking about that. But the guys in the simulator worrying about whether or not he's made a mistake on the radar. Have I got my navigation right? I'm with my peers. I've got 4 coxswains in the room with me. I've known this guy for 20 years as the coxswain down the coast. I don't want to drop a clanger in the bloody simulator while he's next to me. So we started thinking, well, are they concentrating on the behavioural stuff? Or are they spending more time worrying about, do I make a technical clanger? And he gave us the other problem, which again Rick highlighted earlier, is if we see a technical clanger in the simulator, at what point do we not keep it to ourselves? At what point do we go to the guys who are signing off to say these people are competent to go to sea and point out the fact that actually a basic collision rule like restrictive visibility, the bloke got it wrong? So it became a real challenge for us, isn't it? A real sort of quandary for where we went with it. I'll come to where we're going to go with it in a moment and where we're at next. The final thing we have done, though, and we have opted to do, is we don't do full jeopardy simulation. The aim of simulation within the human factors style of things and type of things is to stop at the point we've demonstrated the behaviour, not at the point we've destroyed the bloke's confidence. So there we go. We've got to pause the simulation. Okay, guys, let's have a look back at that. What we saw there was a guy going into fast time. What we saw is a really good example of verbalisation. Can you see how the chap was telling his every thought? What we saw was a really good briefing. What we saw was a great acceptance from a guy really junior who said, excuse me, boss, have you seen this? We pause it at that. We don't go to full jeopardy because we feel in this environment, when we're teaching the human element, it's destructive. And we have seen some evidence of that. In our other training, navigational training and that sort of training, that's different. And we separate the two quite clearly. Technical training or human-type command training. And we do separate the two quite nicely. So that's a little bit about how we've implemented it. What have the outcomes been? Well, again, we'll look what the attendees have said, first of all. And given that we're a volunteer organisation, what our guys think is pretty important. Because when we ran the pilots, we were quite clever. It wasn't mandatory. The course was not compulsory in the first 12 months we ran it. What we did do was encourage people on, and we brought on a wide demographic of those units of change management. We brought the challengers in, and we brought the chasers in. And we let the word get out there. But this is the feedback. What's particularly satisfying for me is that this feedback ranges from the old crusty coxswain who actually, in the case of that guy, did used to sail lifeboats to sea. In his first ever time aboard a lifeboat at 17 was hoist the main engine, please. Down to guys who were 4 years in and just looking at becoming coxswains. So, you know, it's quite a good spread of feedback for us there. Other results, well, we went into it with no set expectations. We went into it to try it, to see it, and to develop it. And as all the aviators know, and I think Rail now know, and other industries have highlighted, whichever one of you in the room comes up with the metric for measuring it to take to the CEO to prove the value and the worth of the training, you'll be very, very, very rich, I understand. However, for us, the fact our demographic is enjoying it, we've now got a positive image. People want to come on the course. They walk through the door wanting to engage. Whereas a year ago, when it was unknown, they walked through the door thinking they were going to get pinned against the wall and beaten with a stick, which only happens rarely, obviously. Future-wise, well, we intend to build on a success. We've started with a communications element primarily. We're looking at bringing in other human factors elements. We need to expand on the simulator. The simulator, we need to write very clever, very specific, very, very well choreographed incidents. We need to go into our simulator saying this session, in our minds as trainers, is to demonstrate and prove this behaviour as a training tool, rather than just coming up with a really Gucci scenario where loads of stuff happens, but not really having a clear aim of what we're trying to get from it. We need to do that so that we can control the things that happen and get a clear outcome. And also to better emphasise the learning points that we're going with there. So that's really what the outcomes have been for us. In summary, the RNLI, I've just said, we're a charity. We're entirely funded by voluntary contributions. We operate 100 miles offshore in the UK and Ireland. From why we've done this point of view, well, 90% of our problems are people problems. We've had incidents that have got very, very common human secondary elements building up to them. From an implementation point of view, we've had to recognise we've got a broad demographic, a very challenging demographic in some ways. So we've gone for a staged process, we've sown the seed, we've started it quite softly, we've gone external purely to take away that threatening element of another mariner telling another mariner how to do it. In terms of simulation, we've recognised that it's not quite as simple as we thought it was. We can't just steam in there, turn all the buttons on, make it hard, and expect to get the result we want, and we need to work better with that. In terms of the future, we need to develop our simulation scenarios, and we need to work now to bring in whatever we feel is the next most appropriate level of HF training to include for our cockpits and mechanics. That's it from me. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you.